Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. We'll look ahead to the Democratic National Convention coming up this month in Chicago. Some Democrats are worried about protests, especially over Israel's war on Gaza. Illinois politics can be complex and often difficult to understand. A newly released Citizen's Guide to Power, Politics, and Government tries to give a clearer picture of what's going on and help create a more informed electorate. Many parts of Illinois are dealing with a lack of mental and behavioral health providers. We'll get details. We'll also talk about farmers' use of drones and why that may only increase in the future. We'll visit an Illinois city that's been deemed dementia-friendly and learn how some young readers find more confidence with a four-legged friend. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A march near the Democratic National Convention in Chicago this month will focus on the Biden administration's support for Israel in Gaza. Some Democrats are worried that protests could play into Donald Trump's hands. Chip Mitchell has more.
The coalition behind the August 19th march includes more than 150 groups.
It is going to be massive, tens of thousands of people.
Spokesperson Hatem Abudeya chairs the U.S. Palestinian community.
It's an opportunity to tell the entire world that Palestine has support, even in the United States. Not only that genocide Joe Biden and killer Kamala are complicit in the genocide, but that the reason they are supporting Israel unequivocally is because of the U.S. empire.
And on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Abudeya doesn't see much difference between the major U.S. parties.
The Republicans and the Democrats both have the same policy around Palestine, which is to support the racist Zionist state.
Now, it's true there are Democrats who believe the Hamas attacks on October 7th justify how Israel has responded in Gaza. And there are Democrats who oppose Palestinian self-determination. But it's also true that many Palestinians in both Gaza and the U.S. believe a Republican victory in November would only make things worse. Hamilton College historian Morris Isserman has a warning for anyone who's thinking about joining the Chicago protests. He says they should take lessons from what happened in the city outside the Democratic National Convention in 1968.
The organizers were well-intentioned, but they were caught up in the moment.
The whole world is watching, chants the crowd on the side.
They thought that the image of disorder in the street would rebound to their credit and to the strength of the anti-war movement, that people at home watching this on CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite were going to say, oh, this is horrible. The Chicago police are, you know, attacking these protesters in the streets.
Isserman was 17 at the time and says he bought into that idea himself. But more people blamed the anti-war movement for the Chicago chaos, and he says the Democratic Party came off as somehow facilitating it.
Allowing the Republicans and Richard Nixon to portray themselves as the party of law and order. The country paid the price, and so did Southeast Asia, for Nixon's election in 1968. With the extension of the war in Southeast Asia, including the invasion of Cambodia, bombing of Cambodia.
Isserman believes now is not the time either for what he calls revolutionary fantasies.
I think this is a moment for the defense of American democracy. Anything that undermines that and boosts the authoritarian threat to American democracy posed by Donald Trump and the MAGA Republican Party is the opposite of responsible leftism. It's nihilism.
Longtime Democratic National Committee member James Zogby is coming to Chicago. He founded the Arab American Institute. It's holding educational events on Gaza indoors. He says he won't have time for street protests, but says they're inevitable.
We're 10 months into this conflict. The suffering has been intolerable and has been gripping so many different people.
Still, Zogby says the protest leaders need to rein in anyone provoking violence or spouting anti-Semitic slogans.
Getting angry is not a political strategy. Being aware of the fact that you are voices for the voiceless, people who can't be there, people in Gaza, means a responsibility to make the case effectively.
Abu Deya, the protest spokesperson, he says the coalition is training hundreds of volunteer marshals to keep marchers on the planned route, de-escalate conflicts, and protect people from police and counter-protesters.
At the same time, we are not going to take responsibility for the Democrats losing the election.
If the Democrats lose because of their Gaza policy, he says, it's only on them.
Chip Mitchell reporting. People from all over the country travel to Illinois for abortions. Access has disappeared across much of the South and Midwest. That brings a bigger spotlight on Chicago and potential for tensions to simmer as the city hosts the DNC this month. Abortion providers and advocates are making sure clinics will be safe and that patients can get to their appointments in case traffic is a mess. Kristen Schorsch reports.
Dr. Allison Cowett is used to people protesting outside her abortion clinic in the West Loop.
Jesus over every mother in that room right now.
Her clinic is just off the I-90 expressway. It's easy to get to from O'Hare International Airport if you don't count traffic. It's popular with people who travel from other states. Some people fly home the same day. And this clinic is popular with protesters, too. But Cowett knows these protesters. She says they've been loud, intimidating, but not violent. It's the unknown ahead of the convention that makes her nervous.
The out-of-state folks, the people that might be coming to Chicago with different intentions, who will they be? Will there be violence or more unrest?
Abortion is on an even bigger stage. Vice President Kamala Harris is likely going to be the Democratic presidential nominee at the convention. She's an outspoken advocate for a woman's right to choose. Here she is in Wisconsin at her first rally as a presidential candidate.
We who believe in reproductive freedom will stop Donald Trump's extreme abortion bans because we trust women to make decisions about their own body.
Gary McCarthy runs his own security firm and used to be Chicago's police superintendent. He recommends abortion clinics close during the convention to be safe. Why take the risk, he asks.
By opening themselves up, they're not only putting themselves in jeopardy, they're putting their clients in jeopardy. There are crazies out there, and we don't know what they're going to do.
But Cowett says closing is not something she'd ever consider. Family Planning Associates is one of the biggest independent abortion clinics in the country, treating at least 200 patients a week. They come from as far as Texas and Florida. The convention is 4 days long. Shutting down could delay care.
This type of sort of potential threat is something that we are dealing with year-round. And that doesn't mean that we're naive to what the possibilities are. It just means that we're not going to be easily scared away.
Cowett says she plans to meet with building security to see what additional needs her clinic might have. I asked Chicago police and emergency management officials about safety plans for abortion clinics, and they didn't comment. In the meantime, clinics and advocates are thinking about how to make sure patients can get to their appointments during the convention. Leave more time to get there, for example. And there's also just how expensive it will cost to stay in a hotel. The Chicago Abortion Fund helps pay for that. When Taylor Swift was in town last year, Kadcia Sharif with the Abortion Fund said a hotel stay cost $600 to $700 a night.
That weekend, we ended up spending over $30,000 on hotel stays, which is definitely more than we typically spend on hotels. And we used that experience to learn for when Beyonce came to Chicago and tried, like I mentioned before, to pre-book some hotel rooms.
The backdrop to all of this is being upfront with patients. Chicago traffic is already notoriously bad, and it could be worse during the convention. So it actually might be quiet inside clinics if some patients decide to avoid the headache and come the week before or after the convention. Kristen Schorsch, WBEZ News.
Drones flying over Midwestern fields are likely to become a more typical sight. Farmers are finding the remotely piloted aircraft can do everything from spraying fields to monitoring livestock. And as Michaela Voris reports, experts say drones are becoming an important part of farmers' toolboxes.
Jeremiah Gebhardt stands on his family farm in rural Salisbury, Missouri, demonstrating a T-30 drone's sprayer system by watering a nearby field.
So we'll see what it looks like. I'm actually going to fly it a little lower than normal just because of the wind.
Buying any new farm equipment can be expensive, so adding drones was not a decision that Gebhardt made overnight.
And I came up that if we applied our own aerial spraying fungicide on our ground, plus I could do some for some other farmers in the area, I thought it'd be worth it.
Gebhardt uses drones to spray his corn, soybean, and wheat fields. He first encountered the technology while in college at the University of Central Missouri.
Then after I graduated, I met the owner of AgriSpray, and it was actually at Mizzou Crop Management Conference. And I saw his demo, and I'm like, man, that may be something I want to get into.
AgriSpray drones began selling drones mostly for agriculture in Central Missouri in 2019. Jordan Sayer, a key account manager, says increasing demand has helped the company grow.
I started in 2022 as employee number 5, and now there's 25 of us. And we went from about a 6,000 square foot building to our 30,000 square foot building here in Boonville, Missouri.
Farmers adopt technology that they know will ultimately help their business, says Doug Hauser. He's a digital agriculture extension specialist from Iowa State University. And Hauser says he spends a lot of time talking with farmers about drones.
Why is there interest in extension for the drone technology? Because farmers are asking. Every conference, every meeting I go to, I find farmers that are asking, you know, what's the latest technology and trends? Can I do this? Can I do that?
In a 2021 survey from Iowa State, 21% of farmers reported using drones, while more than 30% said that they plan on using drones in the future. Drones help save money for farmers, partially by getting closer to plants and lessening chemical loss. Safety is another benefit, says Kevin Knorr, owner and CEO of Volatent Drone Technology Solutions in Dunbar, Nebraska. Knorr says farmers applying chemicals from sprayers often drive right through the chemicals, making exposure more likely.
Every time they turn around, they turn right back around in it. You know, there may be cabin filters and whatnot that keep that out, but can we fully trust that that operator's not in it?
While drones do have their shortcomings, such as limited battery life and restrictions on the chemicals that they can spray, a big plus for many farmers is convenience. Sean B-Dub Barstow is a drone flight instructor at Utah State University. He says farmers are especially pleased to find out drones could make it easier to check livestock.
The fun thing for us is when we do a little workshop, a farmer comes up and says, wait a minute, are you saying there's 2 feet of snow on the ground? I have to go check my water. I can get out of my truck, fly my drone over, check my water, and then fly right back and not get wet? I'm like, yeah.
In order to safely and legally fly drones, farmers do need access to training. Back in Missouri, Jeremiah Gebhardt says he got the assistance he needed when he bought his first drone a couple of years ago from AgriSpray.
You need to be able to fix the drones yourself in that field when you have a breakdown. And it's important when you're operating any piece of machinery that you understand how it works.
Gebhardt says using drones is a learning process, but he's found every year he's been able to spray his fields more efficiently.
Michaela Voris with that report. It can be difficult for youth who struggle with reading to build confidence. Libraries have been deploying Man's Best Friend to help. Melissa Ellen with WGLT attended a recent Tales for Tales session at Bloomington's Public Library, where youth are invited to read out loud to therapy dogs.
Brittany Broker says she started taking her daughter to Tales for Tales because she was having some trouble in school. After just one Bloomington Public Library session, Broker says her daughter is more proactive about her reading.
She's excited about coming to the library. She's excited about reading. She actually will practice reading at home because she wants to be prepared for when she's reading to the dog. She really enjoys the attention she gets to give them.
Broker says she can see her daughter becoming a more confident reader as a result.
So this was a really nice way for her to start reading to somebody who made her feel safe at the same time to build some of those reading skills and that confidence.
Bloomington Public Library isn't the only place that offers this reading service in the community. Public libraries in Carlock and Towanda both have free programs for youth to read to dogs as well. Piper Arrington is the program director at Towanda Library. She's been running its Reading with Dogs program for just under 2 years, though it's been around for longer. Arrington says it's a less intimidating way to read.
I think it takes a lot of the pressure away from reading because they're not necessarily reading to a person that's going to say, oh, you mispronounced that or you missed a word there or this is how you do this. When they're reading to the therapy dogs, it's really just about them getting the kind of like the rhythm of reading without being interrupted. And they love the dogs. They almost always have like one hand on the book, one hand on the dog.
Bloomington has been running Tales for Tales for roughly a dozen years. Bloomington Children's librarian Alex Bell says it was designed with reluctant readers in mind, but anyone grades K through 5 can attend. Siblings with little reading ability will come, so she includes coloring sheets. Bell also uses these to distract kids when they need to leave.
Because often it's hard to kind of tear them away from the dogs, and so I want to be able to have something to smooth the transition.
Each youth or family gets 15 minutes with a dog to read and interact. Bell has to keep things on a tight schedule for the hour-long program so everyone gets a chance to participate. As is, slots are almost always filled. Several of the folks who attended last week's Tales for Tales session had gotten in last minute from off the wait list. That includes Brittany Broker and her daughter. The Reading with Dogs program also gets repeat patrons. At Towanda Library, program director Piper Arrington says children often get to know the dogs well.
They have a favorite that they'll go to every time when they see them when they run in.
Arrington says the youth get to talk with the dog owners, providing important social interactions.
What'd you eat for lunch?
Carol Danker is the owner and handler for Bubba. Danker says she's been participating in the program since its inception. She says therapy dogs help a great deal in these spaces. She takes Bubba all over Bloomington Normal to nursing homes and schools. Danker says dogs like Bubba can give a mental health boost.
Say a person is having a really bad day, all right? They come in and they see Bubba, they immediately just light up. And it's just, that's really cool that they're able to open up.
Libraries run the program year-round, so the chapter never ends.
You can choose another book from up there if you want to read it or
Melissa Ellen with that report. A primer on Illinois government and politics. We'll have that for you coming up here on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois politics can be difficult to understand, from a culture of political corruption to the rise of billionaire candidates and backers, and the continued control of the four top legislative leaders in the General Assembly. It's a confusing landscape. There is help. Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide to Power, Politics, and Government has a new edition. It's the first update in 15 years, and it's now out from the University of Illinois Press. In this interview with Charlie Schlinker, the lead author, Melissa Moritzson of the College of DuPage, tells you how the traditional regional power blocks of Chicago, the suburbs, and downstate have changed to Chicago and Cook County, the suburbs, and downstate.
I think our traditional sort of understanding of state politics was that Chicago was kind of an island unto itself, and that the suburbs were also like this monolith. What we've learned a lot over, you know, the past actually 15 years, is that the suburbs are unique and distinctive, and it's suburban Cook County and DuPage County, not just politically, but also economically and socially. And so those almost micro contextual factors make a difference when we're trying to understand the politics that happen at the ground level, but also how then the state officials interact with each other in the General Assembly.
So a couple of examples of how that inflects both the General Assembly and statewide leaders.
The idea of suburban sort of legislator is that the stereotype of, you know, any sort of suburban politic, right? When the truth is that suburbs like Berwyn or Cicero have more in common economically and socially with the city of Chicago than they do with a suburb like Naperville. So Naperville is, has a lot more money, has a lot more resources, better funded schools. And so when these legislators are in the state house, the things that they're asking for, right, funding for school or funding for roads or the things that they're asking for, the Berwyn and Cicero legislators probably have more in common with the city legislators. So it's created, right, this grouping sort of Cook County versus the rest. The relationships are still dynamic. But the things, right, that they're asking for or working toward are more similar.
Downstate metro areas have in recent years contributed to Democratic Party dominance in the legislature, partly because of political redistricting and partly because of changing metro area demographics downstate. Given that, why didn't you go with a more rural-urban framing of blocks?
I think that's something that we definitely should explore, hopefully, if there's a fourth edition. I think that's an excellent critique of the book, that if we only had the time or the space. But your point is absolutely right on, that they have, and now we have these super majorities, and it's because of this redistricting.
You write of increased population diversity, outmigration of non-Hispanic whites, growth in Asian and Latino populations, and in people from other countries. You say that's helping cause a transition of Illinois from a moderate to a liberal polity and to increase political polarization of the kind seen nationally. Why is polarization a consequence of that diversity more than, say, a tendency by political parties to create those safe seats?
The increasing diversity has created a different situation where there's a competition, a different sort of competition for resources, especially with the increase in the Latino population in Chicago, in Cook County, and to a little bit in the collar counties. The resource needs are just different. And so that's caused a change within the party itself, which isn't always the same as the change that's happening with the party at the national level, right? What Democrats are arguing about in Kansas is not the same thing as what Democrats are arguing about here in Illinois, right? A DuPage Democrat is totally different than a Cook County Democrat, but it has to do with the different diversity in their populations. The diversity in DuPage County, for instance, is more Asian, right? The diversity in Cook County, in the collars, let's say, is more Latino. We can't always say that, like, just because someone comes from another country, they're going to be part of the Democratic Party.
What other consequences or developments have there been from this increased diversity in Illinois politics?
Particularly the influx of Latino immigrants has caused sort of a strain on some of the suburban governments, because the city is prepared for it, but the suburbs are ill-prepared to deal with a lot of this stuff. They just don't have the resources. And in some areas, they just don't believe in it, right? It's not part of their political culture to do this sort of stuff. The city has a long history of it, so it's not a question necessarily of if, it's just when and how. But in some of these areas that were created to avoid exactly what's going on in the city, and now they're experiencing the same sort of challenges, there's just no there's no resources. And sometimes, no desire, a lack of desire to confront some of these challenges.
A new part of the book is a chapter on Illinois corruption. The joke, not joke, is how has there never been such a chapter in the two previous editions? But the legitimate question is, what is new about Illinois political corruption that's necessary to understand the dynamics of the state?
So I guess it's not new that it's persistent, right? That it's deep and persistent. I'll say that we had Kent Redfield come on as a full co-author, and he has a really, deep breadth of knowledge on this stuff. So we absolutely wanted to take advantage of that and have a whole chapter. I think it's important for people to understand that, because when they think Illinois corruption, they think Chicago. They think maybe some in the General Assembly, but I don't think that they realize that it's pervasive in the suburbs as well. When I was at UIC, we did several studies that showed it's almost as pervasive in many suburbs. So we can't turn a blind eye and just say, oh, that's a city problem. But also, more recent studies within the past 2, 3, 4 years have shown that corruption is actually on the decline in Illinois. We still rank number one as a region. But if we look at like year over year, we are starting to decline. So that's a good thing.
Would you also amplify your point in the book? The consequences, even if it is an instance of corruption in Chicago or the Chicago suburbs, are statewide. How is that?
Two things I would say, like a physical sort of consequence, which is a thieving of resources, which leaves a neighborhood, a municipality, a community without, and so they still need, and so there still needs to be provision of those services. But the larger consequence is this mistrust and this disbelief that Illinois can provide proper governance, because everyone just assumes, oh, someone's on the take, the fix is in. And so if we're ever going to confront big challenges where we need a statewide base of support, such as pensions, we're going to need that trust in our government, but in our elected officials to do that. And when you just assume, you know, every other one is going to go to jail for something, it's hard to then say, oh, okay, my pension is safe or the pension plan is going to be fixed.
Are you and your co-authors hopeful on this front?
Tempered sort of hope. I think that, you know, Pritzker has done some great things and, you know, coming out of the pandemic, we're in a better place, especially education-wise than we have been. But the pension crisis is coming at us like a Mack truck and no one seems to have a solution for it.
In documenting the lack of reform in the state, you write in the book, there's never been a time when the political leadership of the state has come together absent the pressure of a recent major political scandal and committed to a comprehensive effort to think about how a statutory and behavioral norm-driven regime could be developed. Why isn't there more action on ethics?
I think it's twofold. First of all, if you're running for office, like ethics is a great you know, thing to run on, but then when you get there, you have so much stuff to do. It's not that ethics goes by the wayside, but ethics is more amorphous, right? What you think is ethical and what I think is ethical might be two very different things. Is it unethical for two brothers to serve on the same park district board, right? Some people think that's just fine, but other people think it's unethical. So sort of coming up with an operational definition of what ethics or an ethics reform package is can depend on people's experience and their culture and their sort of education on these matters. But also I think it's because when our elected officials get into office, there's so much other stuff. There's immediate problems that are confronting them that they have to deal with before a flood or a tornado or some other crisis.
But it's not like they need to reinvent the wheel. I mean, you and your co-authors came up with a pretty long list of things that are, you know, well established in other locations that could be fitted for Illinois. Why not? Why hasn't this happened? There ought to be time for ethics. Shouldn't there be?
Oh, yes. So I was trained by Dick Simpson at UIC, and we've been working on this stuff for 15 years. He's been working on it much longer than I have. It seems to be a lack of will, like political will. And what explains the lack of political will? You know, if we can find somebody who has that answer and then can turn it on and motivate them, they should be the next governor of Illinois.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with political scientist Melissa Morrison about the book coming out from the U of I Press, Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide to Power, Politics, and Government. There are new separate chapters on social policies or people services, where most of the spending in the state is to be found, on state regulation of individual behavior. Why are these important to treat as separate chapters from, say, taxing and spending?
Because they, in and of themselves, are important. Can hopefully illuminate for Illinois citizens sort of not just what the problems are, but what the potential solution can be. What we heard from people who had read our book or people who are familiar with our work was there was a particular interest in state regulation. And Jim Nolan is an expert in this area, given his expertise. It's important if we're talking about this being a guide for citizens that citizens have, you know, these separate chapters and these separate ways to illuminate.
Let's talk about the billionaire era of Illinois politics, from Republicans Bruce Rauner, Ken Griffin, and Richard Uihlein to Democrat J.B. Pritzker. How has that changed the landscape?
Like a lot of the country, right? The funding has meant that they have more influence, right? A particular sort of influence that has made a lot of people look at the United States and say we're more oligarchical instead of being more of a democracy. If I run a campaign and I can get a support, the support of a billionaire, right? Then that's all I need. And so it changes the way that I need to approach my constituency or the way that I need to approach sort of my time. But the biggest sort of underscore is that they have way more influence. And so now we have to worry about, will the billionaires be happy? Not, what are we doing for the average citizen?
Money does amplify a voice, as you say, but aren't there limits on that voice? I mean, it still is a political system with other actors.
It still is, right? And so maybe that's more like, instead of being a one-sentence answer, that's more like a class to see the influence of actors. But when you have a ton of money and you don't have to go ask individual people, right? It prevents them from having to go and ask individual people, which may change their platform and may change their approach to politics. It's less small-D democratic.
Is this, do you think, a permanent trend? I mean, we've seen Bruce Rauner and Ken Griffin exit the state political scene. Isn't there a limiting factor of age and interest on any billionaire that takes a flyer?
It remains to be seen, right? But I would think that at some point, right, you need a counter sort of to that. And where is the counter to that? You know, people may have what we call in political science slack resources. They may have the interest or the time, but as you said, amplifying sort of that voice, they may not have the ability to do so. If I can't get it on the news or on a billboard, or I can't pay for a bunch of mailers, that limits my ability to communicate my message.
There's presence, and then there can be an effect from absence as well. If and when they exit a scene, what are the consequences to the Illinois political system?
I think we're seeing that sort of a little bit with the Illinois Republican Party now that some of the billionaires have left. And so the Illinois Republican Party doesn't have funding and they can't get their message out. Of course, you know, a lot of the dominance by the Democrats has to do with redistricting. But if I'm a Republican, even in a purple area, and I have a hard time getting my message out, it means that there's less representation. There's lots of jokes about Democrats in Illinois, but the truth is, if we look at presidential returns, right, how many people are voting for the Republican? About 35 to 40%. It's not reflected, right? That difference in opinion, that difference in political desire is not reflected in the system that we have. And, you know, if we are a Republican form of government, we should have accurate representation of all voices.
How has the roster of players for institutional political fundraising changed since the last edition, and why? I found that part of the book really fascinating.
In addition to the super rich having more influence, we're seeing now like more of a dominance by unions, but unions in the Democratic Party. And that means a lot, right? If you can get, unions are working together too, some of them. And so if you can get more support, say from the IEA or the IFT, that helps propel your message. It also says something, right, about the working relationship between these unions and these state officials. So I think that has changed, probably second to the billionaire influence.
Unpack that a little more. How has it changed? What's happened?
Especially in DuPage County, for instance, right, the sheer influence of union money or union-backed candidates has meant that the dominance of Republicans in DuPage County, so besides the change in desire and whatever, there's an ability now for more better funded candidates, better funded Democrats to win, but you need to get the endorsements, right? The endorsement game has always been a game, but now it's even more important for political candidates to get certain endorsements because they come with these bigger checks.
You and your co-authors write, you feel leaders and followers in Illinois need to address fundamental challenges more forcefully and to trumpet more loudly the many strengths Illinois offers, because you don't think Illinoisans, the nation, and the world appreciate the state's advantages. What don't they appreciate?
Well, we're a punching bag and we're a joke, right? And we're constantly the butt of people trying to get elected nationally. But if we drill down, we have a great university system. I'm the product of UIS and UIC. So our state system is amazing. All the conversation lately is about the lack of funding, but we have a wonderful education system. We have wonderful natural resources. We have some of the most beautiful forests, like in Southern Illinois. But I think it's just simple things like that. We still have one of the strongest economies, right? One of the largest. The Chicago metropolitan region rivals countries. We have a layering, right, of different types of industry. There's a whole host of things that I make my students listen to in class that make Illinois a really great state if we can stop for a second making fun of the corruption and the Democratic dominance.
What haven't we talked about that's important to understand about the book and how it could be useful to your average citizen?
I would love to say as much as possible about my co-authors. Jim Nolan and Kent Redfield are teachers to their bones. Their desire in this book to make it a guide for not just students, right, but for anybody who wanted to be a student of politics. We've taken great care to make it not seem textbooky, to make it accessible to the average person, so that, you know, if a student wanted to, an 18-year-old freshman wanted to read it, or a graduate student, or just somebody who moved to the state, to make it so that it's friendly and accessible and helps people understand more about Illinois. We talk about government, but we also talk about politics so that you can have a holistic sort of understanding. You know, the biggest thing I think is that it is a citizen's guide. Do you want to be a citizen of Illinois? Here's a way to help you understand.
That's political scientist Melissa Moritzen of the College of DuPage. Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide to Power, Politics, and Government is out now from the University of Illinois Press. Co-authors are Kent Redfield and Jim Nolan. Moritzen spoke with Charlie Schlinker. More to come on Statewide. Stay right here. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. New reports show big swaths of northern Illinois have a lack of mental and behavioral health providers for children. For more on that story, here's Peter Medlin.
A pediatrician notices that a young child is struggling and needs mental health support like a psychologist. They make a referral and the child gets support. Simple as that, right? Advocates say, if only. They say there are many steps in the process where they lose families. After you realize your child needs help, you could spend months on a wait list to see a mental health provider. The nearest therapist might be an hour or two away, and maybe your insurance doesn't cover it, or you finally see someone, but then the therapist quits because there aren't enough providers, and high turnover and burnout are common.
Now you have to start over, because you have to build that trust with that therapist.
That's Lou Ann Hayes. She's a regional council manager with Birth to Five Illinois, a state initiative analyzing early childhood needs across the state. And her region covers Stevenson, Carroll, and Joe Davies counties. And Birth to Five's new report focuses on access to mental and behavioral health providers.
It's very sad. We are inadequate with the needs of our community.
Hayes says that's the headline. There are simply not enough mental health providers, from clinics to schools to hospitals. And that creates a series of other issues that compound stress for families right from the beginning. She says most people get referrals from their pediatrician or their child's doctor. But in her three-county region, there is only one pediatrician and over 5,000 children. So that can make it harder to catch a developmental delay or a mental health concern. Livia Bain is another regional council manager, and her region includes Boone and Winnebago counties. And she says because of the lack of providers, once you get that referral, then you start waiting. It could take months just to get a screening to figure out what kind of therapy they need. And the waits are long, even if the child's mental health situation is very serious.
When you're in a crisis, you may find yourself waiting between 2 and up to 6 months for your child to be seen, to have the referral even met, or to actually sit down, you know, with a healthcare provider and then to come up with a plan.
Lindsay McDaniel knows this too well. She's a Freeport teacher with 5 children, some of whom have gone through mental health crises.
We got on the list for the Research Triangle of Chicago for a psychological exam. Literally, our appointment was booked 9 months out. 9 months. I mean, how devastating as a parent to know with these explosive, disastrous behaviors that are turning your house upside down that you have 9 months to wait before you're even going to have testing. After the testing's done, they have 60 more days to fill out the paperwork.
And after all of that, you might find a therapist or a psychiatrist, but depending on where you live, they might not be close. McDaniel's had that issue too, coming from Freeport.
I exhausted everything from Stevenson County into Winnebago County, even into the Chicago area. And we just really struggled to find help that was making any kind of long-term difference.
Hayes says she's seen people have to drive to Madison or Peoria to see a provider. That could be impossible for some families without reliable transportation. And many do offer telehealth services, but not many are willing to make the trip up to Northwest Illinois. Now, say you've connected with a professional in your area, and insurance could still throw a wrench in the process. It can be a challenge to find providers who take state-funded insurance, and the level of mental health services available is often based on the tier of insurance you have. Livia Bain says that's definitely true for public insurance like Medicare, but also for private coverage.
Those co-pays just add up over time and become very financially prohibitive to seeking the services.
And when the short staff providers burn out and leave, the process starts all over again. So they say the situation is rough, but what can be done? Bain says local investment can help. In 2020, Winnebago County voters approved a half-cent sales tax to fund mental health services, and so far, more than $20 million has been distributed to over 40 providers. And she says that's helped reach more people who need services, but they haven't completely met the need yet. Hayes says Birth to Five is also working on an action plan over the next few months with even more concrete ideas to improve mental and behavioral health access. And for the parents of these kids, it can't come soon enough. I'm Peter Medlin.
Coal ash is a byproduct of burning coal. It contains toxins like mercury and lead. Illinois lawmakers have taken steps to provide more oversight of dozens of coal ash sites across the state. But as Madison Holcomb reported in the spring, that process is moving more slowly than some environmental activists would like.
Jermaine Light lives in Danville. On a recent afternoon in early May, she leashes up her dog Pippin, a poodle, and she shows me around Kickapoo State Park, about 15 miles from her home. As we walk along the middle fork of the Vermilion River, she explains how we're only a few miles away from where the Dynegy Power Station operated, up until it closed in 2011. She says the facility and the coal ash that's been left behind has lingering effects.
I have a neighbor that fishes a lot, and he says he prefers not to fish the Vermilion because he knows what's upstream. If he fishes the Vermilion, he throws it back. He always throws them back.
Dynegy Midwest Generation owns three coal ash ponds near the Middle Fork. Some local residents and community activists, like Jermaine, worry the coal ash pollution could get worse. Jermaine says she wishes Dynegy would remove the coal ash ponds entirely. Andrew Rain is the climate policy director at Prairie Rivers Network. He says one way to prevent groundwater contamination is to relocate the coal ash waste into a pond that's properly lined to seal it off. But most of the coal ash ponds are not lined this way.
We basically have a lot of pollution constituents that are leaching into our groundwater. And in some cases, that groundwater is directly connected to surface water. So the Middle Fork of the Vermilion River is kind of a real spotlight example of coal ash and some of the problems around it.
In 2019, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the Coal Ash Pollution Prevention Act, which prohibits coal ash discharge into the environment. As a requirement of the act, Illinois adopted rules in 2021 that assigned the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency to assign permits to coal ash ponds. The rules require power companies with coal ash ponds to apply for a permit from the Illinois EPA, laying out the company's plan to operate on or close the pond site. Then, the EPA must review the permit and go back and forth with the company about necessary changes. The permit then opens for a public comment period. The EPA might then choose to revise the permit or not before officially issuing it. Darren LaCrone with the Illinois EPA oversees this entire process. He says the biggest challenge has been the fact that it's a completely new program.
You know, there's lots of, you know, new rules for existing programs. You know, you're revising how you do things. Yes, we did regulate these impoundments, but not to this degree.
LaCrone says the main reason the process has taken so long is because almost all of the permit applications were submitted around the same time, in the fall of 2021. He says a couple permits are now open for public comment, but to this day, none have been issued. Senior attorney at Earth Justice Jenny Castle says she's frustrated with how long it's taking. She says the EPA hasn't been prioritizing permits for environmental justice communities, which she describes as places that carry a disproportionate burden of many kinds of environmental hazards.
Most of them submitted their applications on time, and yet here we are 2 years later without IEPA prioritizing those sites that are in the environmental justice communities that are posing the biggest risks. So we think that whatever the holdup has been, it needs to not be there anymore.
But LaCrone, with the EPA, says the environmental justice communities have more complicated cases than others.
I mean, I understand their concern and why those haven't gone out first, but they have been our priority for the initial review process. It just doesn't mean they're always then in a position for us to be able to draft the permit first.
He says he expects things to pick up speed going forward. Castle, the attorney with Earth Justice, says it's important that things move quickly.
You know, I think everyone has the right to clean water. We need to make sure that not only we're safe, our children are safe, our grandchildren are safe. We just have to get the coal ash out of the water, and then we can have far safer and cleaner water to drink and swim in.
I'm Madison Holcomb.
Firearm-related injuries are the leading cause of death for young people in the U.S. To lower those numbers in Illinois, Northwestern University, the Illinois Department of Public Health, and other partners will implement a secure firearm safety storage program in 55 community health centers. The program will offer free cable locks to gun owners, then study how clinicians talk to parents about firearm storage, especially in low-income communities. Renad Batis is with Northwestern's Feinberg School.
Our program is all about sharing a secure storage message with parents and offering this free cable lock. So, for example, if someone is housing insecure or has a lot of community violence, how we talk about secure firearm storage needs to be sensitive to that.
Researchers will collect data about gun storage behaviors. Batis says the study will last about 5 years. The town of Washington in Tazewell County officially became a dementia-friendly city at the beginning of the year. Now volunteers continue to work on new ways to support residents with dementia. Colin Shope attended a training event.
Terry Hilligans, Tazewell County's director for the Central Illinois Agency on Aging, helped bring the program to Washington.
You know, it just interests me. You know, I'm retired. I don't have a lot going on, so... just seemed to be something I thought Washington would be a good fit for that, so let's give it a try.
During the hour-long training, Hilligans leads a group of about a dozen Washington community members and business owners through the basic facts of dementia, the warning signs, and how to interact with someone struggling with symptoms. Notably, he also talks about supporting caretakers in the community.
That's a hard job to do, and it's very frustrating. It's endless. I mean, it's 24 hours a day. So I think the more support we can give to caregivers, the better off we're going to be.
One of these initiatives has already started, a regular community support group for caretakers to meet, talk, and get connected with resources. Hilligan says the Washington arm of Dementia Friendly America has conducted about 4 of the training sessions so far, including sessions with the fire and police departments. The city is exploring the possibility of identification bracelets distributed by the police department for those with dementia in case they need help contacting a caretaker or finding a way home. But the efforts at City Services expand beyond the emergency responders.
We do a lot with outreach, so we actually bring materials to those who can't easily get to a library for whatever the reason may be. So in some cases, it could be that they're having some memory issues and, you know, they're not allowed to be driving anymore. So we do twice monthly deliveries for those materials.
That's Savannah McClellan, outreach librarian for the Washington District Library. Besides the delivery of materials, the library has also developed new programs aimed specifically at those with memory issues. Stay Sharp kits, as the library has named them, contain a themed assortment of activities and materials to provide some mental stimulation. As an example, McClellan has one all about dogs.
So there's some games relating to dogs, some information, and it kind of helps bring back memories, you know, of times that like you had with your pets and stuff like that.
Though you may not immediately associate libraries with supporting dementia care, McClellan says it's important for Washington organizations to get involved however they can.
As a library, you know, we're always trying to meet the needs of our community, and some of those community members, they're having issues with memory loss, they're having issues with dementia, and so we're trying to meet them where they are and help improve those things for people in our community, and so we want to provide any resource that we can.
That even includes the transportation in Washington. Jim Bremner is the Washington Township Supervisor and an outspoken advocate of a CityLink partnership that gives Washington seniors rides in town for just a couple dollars and to surrounding towns for $6.
We're an aging society, and that's in every community. But here we want to try to address that, you know, through the dementia side. My own story is my father passed away from it 2 years ago, and he had it for about 2 years before he passed. And when you get to the late stages, it's not very friendly. You know, it's a tough thing.
Bremner has gone through one of the training sessions himself and thinks it's a good tool to raise the general level of awareness of the community. Chevy Creedy, the director of the Washington Chamber of Commerce, hopes the next step is more Washington businesses reaching out to Hiligans, undergoing their own training, and putting dementia-friendly stickers in the windows of shops all over town. A business, she says, may be one of the first places a person notices signs of dementia.
If we can make sure that our front-facing customer service people in the community are aware of the signs of dementia, we can just make sure that people are aware, nobody gets themselves into trouble, and we just are really mindful of those in our community that are interacting with us on a daily basis.
Colin Shope with that report. Washington is one of 30 Illinois cities officially designated as dementia-friendly. We are out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. And join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.